阅读经典的绘画，因为从经典的绘画里面去发展出你的感受力，你的有品味的感受力。因为我说艺术如果缺乏品味的话，那么艺术本来无用，无用的东西它唯一能够支撑它的就是艺术的一种品味。我们中国古代画里面这么说，欧洲画里面这么说，就是这个我们说的审美品质。那么这个审美品质不是空穴来风，它是要经过你对于经典的著作，根据你个人的素质，个人的就是兴趣，去从经典著作里面去阅读出一些东西，去吸收一些东西，而这些东西是能够塑造你的审美品质，同时它又让你去从他们那儿经典作品那儿去发现你所需要的技巧，而这个技巧也是有品质的，不是技巧是本身没有什么，这是第一。第二，你拿了这个东西，你必须处理自然，你要去处理自然，另外一个眼睛看着自然，因为要用自然来赋予你从经典作品里面所学到的东西的心意，那么这就是一种创造。然后你对于媒介本身，你要把握媒介本身的过程，也是通过你跟经典作品跟自然。所以中国古人说画画的办法，就是《古画评论》里面六法里面有一句话很普通，叫“传一墨写”。传一墨写就是面对经典作品去学习经典作品，学习自然，也就是塑造。然后呢，就是你对于艺术的媒介，它不断的在发展。在发展过程当中，就是说你把握住它，然后把你的敏感感受力、敏感性、你的艺术的品味结合在一起，你才能成为一个有希望成为一个真正的艺术家。我们的史论研究者其实也是一样的，无非他面对的经典有两种，一种就是这个作品，经典是经典，然后就是研究者这些作品所产生的一些经典的学术著作。那我觉得像我这次是有共识的，就把这两位这对夫妇请来，其实就是所以他们会讲一些具体的作品。那么我简单的介绍一下这两位学者的一个基本情况。我们先介绍这个林展呢，他目前是执教于牛津大学艺术史系，主要是教授18、19世纪欧洲艺术。他曾经组织过很多大型的展览和国际艺术史的研讨会，他的研究领域还包括法国19世纪的法国绘画以及当时的艺术受众的情况。因为这个很重要，因为我在这儿说呀，牛津大学的艺术史的标志其实就是我们共同的老师 Francis Haskell， 就是 John Whiteley、 Linda Whiteley， 我们都是同出同一师门的。那么这个是因为我们在那个介绍当中可能就忽略了Professor Francis Haskell， 他奠定了就是说牛津大学艺术史的一个性格，同时也使得那儿成为一个研究画家，也就研究艺术与社会的关系，研究艺术与历史的关系这样的一个重镇。那么同时在他之前还有一个学者，德国学者叫温德呢，是瓦尔堡学派里面出来，他是研究意大利文，也是研究意大利文艺复兴时期的一个就是学者。所以这两个人呢，应该是牛津大学艺术史迄今为止最重要。所以呢，我们都是，所以那个林德呢，他也研究了法国绘画和当时的受众之间的关系，而且呢对当代的批评写作和当代艺术所出现的这种市场的情况欧洲他都有一定的研究。那么他与这个就他的丈夫啊一起出版过，就写过法国艺术中的传统革命，从1700年到1800年，这100年之间的法国艺术的传统与革新，这是林德。那么 John 呢，他非常有意思， 然后明天你们会见到。我不知道你们有没有看过一些电影，比如说小绑匪 Kidnap， 然后比如说这个西班牙园丁，比如这个这类电影，如果你们看过的话，你们就知道他以前是一个童星，电影明星，得过奥斯卡青少年。他现在就完全不是那个样，不是一个演员，是一个非常腼腆、非常谦卑的学生。但是从他的神情，因为他从来没告诉我，我是某一次看到电影，我觉得这人怎么那么想。但是呢，他的有些气质仍然保留住了他当童星时候那种天真、那种淳朴里面所透露出来的那种智慧。小孩子，但是你一看就不是机灵，是很淳朴、很温暖，但是呢，透露出一种智慧。所以我觉得 John 跟林的两人的学术也是这样，他们一点都不哗众取宠，就表面看起来非常非常平时，在这个平时的背后，就有一种智慧的光辉。明天我还会再继续介绍他，今天我就给大家个悬念，当你们明天看到他的，你们会难以想象，一个得奥斯卡青少年奖的童星，怎么变得那么腼腆，那么就是。有时候有点无奈，但是他，我刚才说他小时候的那种智慧仍然在他的就是后面能够透露出来。好，下面我们就是欢迎琳达就替代我们那位童星，就是做这个第一个讲座，叫文艺复兴的素描。同时我告诉大家，你们应该去苏州，因为大英博物馆现在藏素描，就是文艺复兴式素描最好的地方，就是阿什米米咱们跟那个布里斯米咱们，当然还有法国。那么你有一个展览，那么我在29号我也到那边去做讲座，就是文艺复兴的素描。所以我觉得你们都应该去看一下。好，下面我们欢迎这个林的替代那个 John 做这个公共艺术的第一讲。意大利民族。
Drawings made by European artists before the middle of the 15th century are extremely rare. Those made after this date survive in vast quantities. Tens of thousands are known from the 16th century alone. One simple reason for this change must be that artists made fewer drawings in the earlier period than in the centuries that followed. Vellum has always been expensive, and paper too, before the invention of the printed book, was not as plentiful as it became. But this cannot entirely explain the huge difference between the earlier and the later periods. It has been calculated that fewer than 100 drawings made in central Italy in the 14th century have been preserved, and nearly all of them are anonymous. It is almost impossible to believe that Giotto did not make drawings while he was working on the beautifully observed figures on the wall of the Arena Chapel in Padua. But if he did make drawings, where are they now?
出自15世纪中期以前欧洲艺术家之手的素描稿十分罕见，而在这一时期之后创作的作品却大量保存下来，但是16世纪就数以万计。有关这种变化的一个简单的原因，一定是因为早期艺术家比后来的艺术家画的素描要少。在印刷书籍诞生前，羊皮纸和纸都一直十分昂贵， 并且数量不像后来一样多，但这并无法完全解释早期与晚期之间因何存在巨大差异。曾有人统计过，大约有不到100幅创作于14世纪意大利中期的素描保存下来，且绝大多数作者不详。我们几乎无法相信乔科在阿琳娜礼拜堂和其他地方的墙壁上绘制那些精美的人物形象时是没有素描草稿的。如果他画过，那么他们又在哪里呢？
Much certainly has been lost. Drawings may have been valued in the earlier period for their practical use or for their beauty, but they were not seriously collected until the beginning of the 16th century. This explains why drawings from the 16th century survive in the tens of thousands. But it also explains why drawings made before this time survive at all. Giorgio Vasari, an early and enthusiastic collector, frequently refers in his Lives of the Artists to his, I quote, book of drawings, which contained not only the work of his contemporaries, but also a number of sheets of drawings attributed to 14th and early 15th century artists, which even then would have been extremely rare, even in Vasari's time. Since this collection has been dismembered, it's difficult now to assess the value of his early drawings, but from those that can be identified, it is clear that many of the drawings he attributed to Giotto and to his contemporaries were either late copies or drawings by later artists. Losses from before the age of collecting must account for much, but the profound difficulty in finding early drawings barely a century after they had been made suggests that drawings by artists working before the early 15th century had never been very common.
那看到的第一张图是乔托的乔吉米的状况，当然大多数都遗失了。素描会早期或许会因为他们的实际用途或美观而被估价，但直至16世纪初，他们都并未被真正当作艺术品来收藏。这便解释了为什么出自16世纪的素描数以万计，也解释了为什么此前的素描多少也有保存。查尔斯·瓦萨里，一位热情洋溢的早期收藏家，他经常在名人传中提及自己的素描之书，其中不仅包括他同时代的素描之作，还有许多是属于14世纪和15世纪初艺术家的，而这些即使在瓦萨里的时代也是十分少见的。但由于他的收藏被分散了，所以现在很难评估他那些早期素描的价值。但从那些可以确定身份的作品中，可以清楚看到许多被他归于乔托的和同代艺术家的作品其实是后人的复制品或后代其他艺术家的作品。在瓦萨里收藏之前的时日的遗失必然是主要原因，但是瓦萨里在这些作品创作后只不过一个世纪想要找到就如此困难，也说明直至15世纪初艺术家画素描草图都并非寻常之事。
Most of the drawings that survive from the end of the Middle Ages have been preserved as pages from dismembered model books. These albums, compiled by artists as a source of useful motifs, emphasize the importance of the role of copying in making art and in transmitting images in this period. Figures, animals, and ornamental detail did not need to be invented with every new work of art, but could be taken from an existing template.And I'm showing here exactly one such pattern, a drawing of a leopard. The use of the copybook encouraged a new realism in the treatment of detail, but it was also responsible for a mosaic effect in the composition of some artists, notably in the work of Pisanello, who was one of the first artists.Whose drawings survive in any number. Pisanello's Miracle of the Eustace in London in the National Gallery.
后面门，
我问一下后面的了，后面有人。
Turns up in paintings and manuscripts of different artists in several different places.
中世纪末以后存留下来的大多数素描都以分散的样本素描册中的书页保存下来。这些画册由艺术家整理，是关于问题的实用、非常实用的原始资料，也强调了在当时创作艺术作品以及传播图像时复制图像所扮演的重要角色。人物、动物、装饰性的细节并不需要在每次创作新艺术的时候都被重新发明，而是可以从现存的模板中直接提取。比如现在我们看到的这个猎豹的素描稿，这种临摹册激发了对细节处理的一种新的写实，但也造成了一些艺术家作品中的镶嵌画式的效果，比如皮萨丹罗的作品。他是最早的留存较多素描稿的艺术家。皮萨丹罗在伦敦国家画廊的作品《圣尤斯塔斯的奇迹》一画中，画了许多动物的侧面轮廓，非常类似于样本素描册中常见的那些。它们散落于表面，色彩鲜艳，带有装饰性。自14世纪晚期到15世纪早期之间，这些素描相对普遍。艺术家在欧洲旅行，会带上他们的样本册，借给自己的同行复制，或反过来自己复制同行的。这样一来，我们看到很多时候来自不同地方的不同艺术家的绘画或手稿上会出现相同的图像。
The Craftsman's Handbook, a practical guide for artists, written by Cennino Cennini in about 1400, provides a wealth of evidence about the purpose and practices of drawing in the later Middle Ages. Cennino recommends that an apprentice should spend his first year drawing with silver point, touching it with pen and wash when the final image had been fixed before attempting to work with the pen on its own. mastery in the use of pen and ink acquired through years of practice, and then I quote Jane Mill, will make you expert, skillful, and capable of much drawing out of your head. We can conclude from this that most drawings in this period were made by students. The long years spent in drawing while still an apprentice gave the mature artist the skill needed to improvise a composition directly on a panel or on a plaster-coated wall. Out of your head, as Cennino remarks, with little or no preparation. Since most surviving drawings dating from the late 15th century onwards were made as studies for finished compositions, the practice of improvising on the panel or wall with little or no preliminary work suggests one major reason why few drawings on single sheets survive from before the mid-1400s. Compared to later centuries, there was little need to make them.
意匠手册是秦尼诺秦尼尼在大约1400年编写的一本艺术家的实践指南，其中提供了丰富的证据，说明中世纪晚期素描的目的和实践。秦尼诺建议，每个学徒的第一年应该学习用明铅笔学画素描，当最终图像调整好后，用钢笔和水彩小心修饰，然后再尝试直接用钢笔作画。经过多年的练习，对钢笔墨水的用法掌握，就他引用一段话，会将你变成一个专家，能够娴熟的不经大脑的快速画出大多数的素描。我们可以由此得出结论，即这一时期的大多数素描出自学徒之手。在学徒时期，长年累月的素描训练会让一位成熟的艺术家具备一种直接在画板或涂了灰泥的墙壁上即兴作画的能力。用吉尼诺的话说，就是不经大脑的，几乎无需准备。既然自15世纪晚期开始，大部分保存下来的素描都是作为最终作品的草稿习作而做的，那么无需或极少做准备工作而直接在画板墙壁上即兴创作的方法，或许也可以解释为什么15世纪中期以前很少有素描稿留存于世，与后来的几个世纪相比，画素描的必要性不大。
The process described by Cennino marks one further point of difference between art in the early Renaissance and art in the centuries before. Though Cennino refers to the role of drawing in the training of the artist, he has in mind copies from the work of the artist's master. He's not unaware of the importance of drawing from nature. Indeed, in a picturesque confusion of metaphors, he recommends it in the strongest terms.I quote, the perfect steersman and the best helm you can have lie in the triumphal gateway of copying from nature. But Cennino's comment is no more than a brief aside in a book where the role of copying and the value of handed down formulae for depicting the natural world are discussed in detail. For Cennino, the authority of tradition is the basis of all good art.It's this attitude which no doubt accounts for a certain formulaic character in much of the art of the Middle Ages. I am showing you here the perfect image of the Virgin Mary by Filippo Memmi in this case. One of the commonest motifs in medieval art was not taken from a real model, but was based on a convention that was handed down from master to pupil.
秦尼诺描述的过程也是早期文艺复兴与之前的艺术之间存在的一个主要差异。当秦尼诺提到艺术家素描训练的作用时，他脑海中想到的是对这个艺术家的师傅的作品的临摹，他并非没有意识到直接对着自然素描的重要性。事实上，他用了多重的隐喻，最强烈的措辞这样建议道：完美的剁手和你能拥有的最好的剁，就在写生的胜利之门。不过秦尼诺的这段评论只不过是他书中一段简单的题外话，书中详尽讨论的仍是临摹的重要性，以及在描绘自然世界时世世代代相传的方法具有怎样的价值。对秦尼诺而言，一切好的艺术的基础就是传统的权威性，无疑正是这样的态度造成了中世纪大多数艺术的一种刻板的印象，比如我们现在看到的图二。完美的圣母形象，这是中世纪艺术 艺术中最为寻常的母题之一，它并非来自真人模特，而是根据师傅传授给徒弟的一种规范而作。
The changes that affected drawing practice in the century after Cennino and its impact in contemporary art are strikingly illustrated by comparing Cennino's text with what the artist and famous biographer Giorgio Vasari says about the role of drawing in the middle of the 16th century. I quote, sketches are, in artist's language, a sort of first drawing made to find out the manner of a pose and the first composition of the work. They are made in the form of a blotch and put down by us only as a rough draft of the whole. Out of the artist's impetuous mood, they are hastily thrown off with pen or other drawing instrument or with charcoal, only to test the spirit of that which occurs to him. And for this reason, we call them sketches. From these come afterwards the drawings executed in a more finished manner, in the doing of which the artist tries with all possible diligence to copy from the round, if he do not feel strong enough to be able to produce them from his own knowledge. Later on, having measured them with the compasses or by the eye, he enlarges from a small to a larger size according to the work in hand.
对比钱尼诺的文字和艺术家、著名传记作家瓦萨里有关16世纪中期素描的地位的论述，可以明显看出，在钱尼诺后的那个世纪，是什么样的变化影响了素描实践以及素描对当代艺术的影响。草图在艺术家的语言中是一种素描初稿，旨在找出一种姿态的样式，是作品的初次构图，它们由方块构成。我们是将其视作整体画作的粗略草稿。艺术家们一时兴起，用钢笔或者其他绘画工具或者炭条仓促画出，只是想试试画出脑海中出现的瞬间情绪，所以我们称其为草图。在这之后的素描则是用比较完善的手法完成的。在素描的时候，如果画家觉得仅靠自己的知识不足以完成，便努力用心力来摹写自然。接下来，借助圆规测量或者凭借眼睛，艺术家根据自己所接订单的要求，把作品由小放大。
The practices that Vasari describes could hardly be more different from Cennino's conception of his art. In Vasari's account, a work of art begins not with a well-tried template or pattern, but with an idea born in the artist's brain in a moment of inspiration and hastily scribbled onto a sheet of paper with the nearest implement to hand. In practice, the first idea would usually have been worked out in several rough drafts before a composition had been set. Correggio's study for the Madonna with St. Jerome is a particularly vivid example of this type, drawn and redrawn in red chalk on a sheet of paper until the group of figures has become as tangled as an unraveled ball of wool, and the side of the artist's hand has smeared pink chalk across the sheet. Finally, in order to preserve some indication of the definitive composition,Correggio fixed the contours with pen and ink, accidentally blotting the paper, as you can see in the process. This rough sketch, or one similar, would have become the artist's guide when posing the figures in the studio and drawing them individually for the life.
瓦萨里所描述的这些操作过程，钱尼诺有关艺术的概念或许并没有太大差别。在瓦萨里的技术中，一件艺术品并非始于一个经过验证的样板，而是源自一个想法。这个想法出自艺术家大脑得到灵感的一瞬间，然后在纸上用最容易拿到手的工具匆匆涂画下来。 具体操作中，在终极作品确定之前，通常会有几次有关最初想法的初稿。克雷乔为圣母与圣热罗姆的创作的习作便是这类作品十分生动的例子。作者反复用红色色粉笔在纸上涂画，直到人物组合纠缠在一起，仿佛拆散的毛线团，而艺术家手所在的一边纸上则沾满了粉色痕迹。最后，为了能够保存最终确定构图中的一些迹象，克雷乔用钢笔和墨水调整了轮廓，并且不经意地会弄脏画纸。这张粗略的草图或类似的图纸，在当时可能作为艺术家的指南，供他们在画室安排人物造型，并逐一对他们画像。
Going from the nude model, and I'm showing you here a pair of studies by Filipino Vicky. Drawing from the nude model became the norm in drawings. It's a practice unknown to Cellino, but it became the norm in the second half of the 15th century. The use of the nude figure was driven by an admiration for the statues of antiquity, and by a sense of the importance of understanding the structure of the human form. In his influential treatise on painting, written in 1425, Leon Alberti advised painters to follow the lessons of nature in preference to the old orthodoxies. This advice, which was no doubt in the air at the time Alberti wrote it, explains why drawing acquired a new importance as a means of exploring and documenting the human figure, and for studying other aspects of the natural world. Leonardo da Vinci, who followed Alberti in scorning the habit of imitation, scrutinized the human body in order to test the conventions of art against the world of nature and to reject them if they did not match. In his hands, drawing was not merely a preliminary stage of painting, but a means of acquiring knowledge. As he liked to point out, drawing could record the natural world more effectively than the written word. Scholars rightly remind us that Leonardo was a child of his time, and that his ideas often had ancient roots. But when looking at the hundreds of his drawings that survived in Windsor Castle and elsewhere, it's impossible not to sense a spirit of inquiry that links him with the explorers and scientists of later ages.
我们现在看到的是菲利波·利比的素描稿，对着裸体模特写生素描，对于钱尼诺来说是陌生的做法，而在15世纪下半叶就已经变成佛罗伦萨的一种常规。对裸体人物的使用源自对古代造像的仰慕，以及意识到熟悉人体造型结构的重要性。1435年，埃尔贝蒂在他颇具影响力的论文《论绘画》中提到，画家应该学习自然的课程，而不是旧的教条。这一建议毫无疑问在当时是一种流行，解释了为什么作为一种探索和记录人体的手段，作为研究自然世界的其他各个方面的手段，素描变得如此重要。莱昂纳多·达芬奇认同埃尔贝蒂，他也对模仿的惯例不屑一顾。他仔细研究人体，为了实验艺术，反对自然世界的规则，如果这些规则不合适，便拒绝他们。在他的笔下，素描并非只是绘画的初级阶段，而是获得知识的手段。就如他想要指出的那样，素描记录自然比文字更有效率。学者们适时地提醒我们，达芬奇是他的时代之子，他的观点常常具有古代的根基。但是，当我们看着他保留下来现存于温莎堡等地的成百上千的素描时，几乎不可能不感受到一种求知精神，正是这种精神将他与日后的探险家和科学家联系在一起。
Initially, Leonardo used the classic tools, pen and metal point, but in the course of the 1490s, without abandoning the pen, which remained his favorite tool, which was the drawing of a unicorn. He began, though, at the same time, to make more frequent use of black and red chalks, both of which are well adapted to modeling the human figure. Black chalk was known to Cennino, although he seems to have thought of it as a substitute for charcoal, and not, as it became, a major implement for making preparatory studies. By the end of the century, however, as figure drawing assumed a central importance in artistic practice, black chalk came into greater use in North and Central Italy. Leonardo learned its value while he was in Verrocchio's studio, and he used it extensively as a way of anticipating the shadowy effects, as you see, that are found in many of his paintings. It's not clear, however, where he acquired his mastery of red chalk. Cennino was already aware of the existence of red chalk, which he describes as a colouring matter that could be used in frescoes, but was good for nothing else. This provides an interesting indication of the value that was put upon it in about 1400. And yet, in a matter of decades, with the rise of preparatory figure drawing, it was a statement that was proved to be startlingly wide of the mark.
最开始，达芬奇使用古代的红曲、钢笔和金属笔尖，但是在1490年代，虽然一方面他仍最偏爱使用钢笔，比如我们看到的达芬奇的独角兽，但同时开始越来越多的使用黑色、红色粉笔，这两种工具都非常适合为人物形象塑形。皮尼诺是知道黑色粉笔的，不过他似乎把它视作是炭条的替代品，而不是制作预备习作的主要工具，而他后来确实是。然而到了世纪末，随着人物素描成为艺术实践中最重要的一环，黑色粉笔在意大利北部或中部被更多使用。达芬奇还在韦罗基奥工作室的时候就认识到了它的价值，他更为广泛地使用它，将其作为表现阴影效果的方法，在他的许多作品中都可以看到这种用法。不过我们并不清楚他是在何地掌握红色粉笔的用法的。吉尼诺已经意识到了红色粉笔的存在，他形容为是一种上色的东西，可以用于湿笔画，但没有什么别的好处了。这就非常的有趣地说明了大约在1400年前后人们对红色粉笔价值判断。然而仅仅几十年后，随着人物素描草稿的兴起，这种说法被证明错的离谱。
According to Vasari, red chalk was found in the mountains of Germany and was introduced to Italy by Leonardo. Although Vasari is not always reliable, red chalk in fact appears very early in Leonardo's art. There is a tiny drawing for the sleeve of an angel in Leonardo's Annunciation, I'm not showing it, in which there is a fragmentary study of the head of the Virgin in red chalk in the upper left.The study is not shaded, but is sharply outlined in the manner of a silver point or pen drawing, suggesting that Leonardo used it at this stage chiefly on account of the fine lines that are possible with red chalk, but less possible with the more friable black chalk. Red chalk is not a chalk at all, but a clay colored with iron oxide. It can be sharpened, I'm showing you a head by Leonardo.It can be sharpened to a point and used for working in outline, but if it's pressed harder with a blunt end, it gives a rich shadowy effect, not as dark as the black chalk, but offering a much more subtle range of tones. By the time Leonardo was working on The Last Supper in the 1490s, he had begun to explore the range of its qualities in a series of expressive head studies. Michelangelo used it in modeling studies,for the Sistine Chapel, for civil preparatory for the Sistine Chapel. All of which were studied in the studio before they were transferred to their place in the final composition. The use of dense red chalk and blank paper allowed him to suggest muscles and sinews with a sculptor's sense of weight and mass, combining delicate outlines with strong shadows.And adding a warmth of colour that resembles the colour of flesh. In his later drawings, perhaps in reaction to the robust virtuosity of his red chalk drawings, he went back to black chalk, using the limitations of the material to create quieter, more contemplative effects. But red chalk, however, was taken up by many of his contemporaries, and it passed into European art alongside black chalk.As one of the classic influences in drawing the human figure.
在瓦萨里看来，红粉笔的原料来自德国的大山，是由达芬奇引入意大利的。尽管瓦萨里所言并不即可尽信，但红粉笔确实很早就出现在达芬奇的作品中。在大约一幅1474年的《圣母领报》中，天使的袖子的习作创作的习作中，在左上角有一个红色粉笔画的圣母的头像片段啊，因为那个图片原来太小了，就没有放在我们的讲座里。这一习作并没有画出明暗，但却用使用银尖笔或钢笔的方法勾勒出明显的轮廓，说明达芬奇在这一时期主要为了画出漂亮的线条而使用这种方法，而他很可能用的是红粉笔，而不是更易碎的黑粉笔。红粉笔其实也并非粉笔，而是一种带有铁氧化物的红色粘土，它能够被打磨成尖头用来勾画轮廓。不过如果用比较大的力气，用钝的一页来画，会形成一种丰富的阴影效果。它不像黑粉笔那么的深，但是却能制造更为微妙的影调范围。截止1490年代达芬奇创作《最后的晚餐》，他便开始在一系列极具表现力的头像习作中挖掘红粉笔的性质。米开朗基罗在为西斯廷礼拜堂创作的人物塑形习作，西比尔女预言家中使用红粉笔，他总是先在画室研究这些人物的形象，然后再画到最终作品的相应位置上去。密集的红粉笔与空白部分的对比，令他能够以一种雕塑家对体量和重量感受来展现肌肉与肌腱，将精致的轮廓线与强烈的影调结合，并且增添一种温暖的色彩来代表肉体的颜色。在他日后的素描中，或许是为了呼应他使用红粉笔素描的精湛技艺，他又重新开始使用黑粉笔，利用材料的局限性来制作更为宁静、更深思熟虑的效果。然而红粉笔被许多同时代人采用，并逐渐成为与黑粉笔一样欧洲艺术画人体、描画人体最为典型的工具。
From an early stage in the 15th century, artists began to separate studies of the figure from studies of drapery. There's an early drapery study of this type in the Ashmolean Museum, drawn by Filippo Lippi, for a figure in a painting of 1447. This is chiefly a study of bulk and volume, anticipating the new sense of space characteristic of the early Renaissance art, drawing metal point on a colored ground and touched with brush and white lead paint to indicate the highlights. Metal point in conjunction with colored paper and lead white was widely used throughout the 15th century when artists drew figures in the studio, but it was an elaborate technique and was largely abandoned in the early 16th century as chalk took over as the favored medium for making studies of this kind.
自15世纪初以来，艺术家开始将人体的习作与衣物习作分开。在阿什莫林博物馆中有一件此类的早期衣物习作，我们现在看到好出自菲利波利比。是菲利波利比于1447年为一幅画作中的人物而作，这主要是一幅关于体量的作品，可预见早期文艺复兴艺术中对空间的一种新感受，是在彩色底板上用金属笔尖画的，并用毛笔和铅白色来表示高光。金属笔尖与彩色纸、铅白色的组合使用，在整个15世纪都广泛流行。当时的艺术家在画室画人物，但是到了16世纪初，这种复杂的技术已逐渐被弃用，因为色粉笔业已成为这类习作最受欢迎的工具。
Once all the components of a composition had been drawn in separate studies, the artist proceeded to combine them into a finished drawing, which corresponded more or less to the idea contained in the first sketch. The composition was sometimes enlarged onto the prepared panel or wall by squaring up the smaller and by popping it onto a larger surface, which had been squared to correspond. The squares allowed the artist to copy small areas at a time, This was easier and more accurate than copying freehand. But the model drawing could also be transferred to a large sheet of paper, or to several large sheets, joined together, which could then be traced onto the panel or wall. This drawing, called a cartoon, from cartone, the Italian for a large sheet of paper, could be prepared in the studio and allowed far greater ease and exactitude in transferring the design to a wall or panel. After fixing the paper in place with paste, the artist could either trace the drawing directly with a point onto the damp plaster, or prick the contours and dab them with a muslin bag of charcoal or dust, leaving an outline of the composition in small dots on the surface. For a panel, a single sheet or number of sheets joined together could be used. The size of a wall or ceiling, as well as the technique of painting on damp plaster, however, made it necessary to cut a cartoon prepared for a fresco into sections large enough to paint in the course of the day before the plaster dried. A great quantity of paper must have been involved in covering walls and ceilings with cartoons, but very few have survived. And just showing the detail of the Verrocchio so that you can observe more closely the system of dots in the balancing. The Holy Family would also always be removed, but the process of transfer was a damaging one, and the eventual artist probably cast them aside when the work was done. Leonardo's cartoon in the National Gallery must owe its survival to the fact that Leonardo did not use it for his final composition, but nothing survives of the vast quantity of paper that must have equaled the area of Michelangelo's ceiling in the Sistine Chapel. Although the evidence of its use remains forever fixed in the plaster surface, where the indented contours pressed into the plaster when it is still wet, and the spots of charcoal where the cartoon has been pumped are still plainly visible.
当画家将一件完整作品中的各个部分都分别画好草图，他便开始将各部分组合成一幅完整的素描，或多或少与最初草图的概念相吻合。这样，一幅作品有时候会被放大，画在准备好的画板或墙壁上。方法是把小图按比例放大，彭托莫的作品，然后把它复制到相应被放大的绘画区域。这种按比例成倍放大的方法，令艺术家可以同时复制几个小的区块。这种方法比徒手复制更简单，也更准确。不过，模板素描也可以被转移到一张更大的画纸上，或者几张拼在一起的纸上，然后再把纸上的图案拓印到画板或墙壁上。这维多基奥的这个素描，这种素描被称之为底图或者纸样，源自意大利语。原意是一张大的纸，艺术家可以在画室里完成这张底图，再把草图转移到墙上或画板上时，这种操作方法更便捷、更精准。艺术家用灰泥将纸固定到位，然后他可以直接用笔尖将草图描在湿润的灰泥墙上，或者沿着轮廓戳孔，再用一个装满碳粉的小布袋轻拍。这样便在墙面上留下了许多由小点构成的作品的轮廓。如果是画板，可以用一层或多层纸，但如果是湿壁画，受限于墙壁和天花板的尺寸以及画湿壁画的技巧，则需要将纸样分割成许多块，尺寸要满足灰泥完全干透前画一天的量，要用纸样覆盖墙壁或天花板，必然要用到大量的纸张，但是几乎不会保存下来。一张纸样，尤其当上面画的是一些寻常的主题，比如圣家族，往往可以被反复使用，但是上述这种转移图像的过程是极具损伤性的，所以一般说来，作品完成之后，艺术家可能便会将其弃之。国家画廊里达芬奇的纸样之所以能够保存下来，一定得归功于他在最终作品中根本没有使用它。但是 能够覆盖米开朗基罗西斯廷天顶壁画区域的数目巨大的纸样也无一幸存，尽管有种种证据证明它们曾被使用，并且永远的被固定在灰泥层。我们可以看到这个西斯廷的这个细部，而在灰泥未干时嵌进去的锯齿状的轮廓和拍纸样时留下的碳粉小点却仍隐约可见。
The existence of the cartoon allowed some changes in the composition before it was painted. It also allowed some reworking after painting had begun, using a second cartoon traced from the original cartoon. And I'm showing you one particular example, a famous study of the heads and hands of two apostles for the record of Raphael's Transfiguration. Now in the Ashmolean Museum, bears clear pounce marks which were made when it was transferred from the first cartoon. These marks are particularly evident in the hair of the younger apostle and also in the hands, especially of the older, but also in the hair of the older apostle, but particularly in the hands of the older apostle, where Raphael has altered these details on the second issue. And you can see it particularly in the position of the thumb in the hands here. When Raphael had reached an advanced stage in his work, he must have stood back from his composition and noticed that the gesture of the apostle's hands was somewhat rigid and theatrical. By shifting the position of the thumbs, Raphael gave the hands an eloquence and an emotion lacking in the first more symmetrical and conventional gestures. And so he didn't alter them, as you can see, the changes were not included in the final composition, presumably because Raphael died from a fever before he was included. You see how the practice of drawing, as it developed in Raphael's studio, became the basis for the teaching and practice of drawing in Europe and North America for the following four centuries. It was a method that allowed the artist to master the appearance of the natural world and to advance cautiously towards the final painting through a process of preparatory work. It was also a method of working that gave great prestige to the art of drawing, that was not seriously challenged until the middle of the 20th century. Academic drawing, as it is known, is now very rarely taught in art schools. To the old-fashioned museum curator, like as John describes himself, this has resulted in a great loss. Mastery in the craft of drawing gave artists at one time a fluency in the language of art, which allowed them to express themselves with wonderful creativity. A poet without genius cannot be taught to write poetry, but a genius who has never learned the rules of syntax will never write a poem of any kind.
纸样的存在令完整作品在上色前仍可进行修改，甚至在已经开始上色时仍可修改，只需在第一张纸样上再描一张纸样。我们看一个例子啊，就是拉斐尔西斯廷的这个壁画的这个基督变容里的一个细节。那我们现在看到的这个 我们现在看到的这个素描稿上跟它最终完成稿上面可能能看到最明显的两个差异，一个是在这个年轻使徒的这个头发的部分啊，那么还有一个可能就是在这个稍微年长一点的使徒他的这个左手的拇指，如果看得仔细一点可能就是我们说的第二张这个纸样盖在上面的痕迹还能看出来。那它看这边这个细节的话就会发现啊，在最终的这个作品中那么这个我先把这个说完啊，现藏于阿什莫林博物馆的这张著名的为基督变容创作的两位使徒手部和头部的习作，就有明显的从前面一张纸样拓印过来的痕迹，在年轻使徒的头发和年长使徒的双手这些痕迹上尤为明显。第二张纸样上，拉斐尔在这些地方都做了改变。当拉斐尔进入这件作品的最后阶段时，他一定曾经退后来看自己的作品，然后注意到使徒的双手有一些僵硬做作。通过改变大拇指的姿势，拉斐尔让使徒的手变得更加传神生动，而在初稿中那些对称的墨守成规的姿势中是缺乏这种表现力的。这些改变在这张作品，在我们这里看到的图片中你可能已经发现，但并没有出现在最终的作品中，大概是因为拉斐尔突然病逝而未来得及做更改。正如在拉斐尔工作室的发展，素描训练日益成为此后400多年欧洲和北美绘画的教学与训练中的基础。正是通过素描，艺术家才得以具备把握自然世界的模样的能力，才能通过一系列准备工作，小心谨慎地完成最终的绘画作品。也正是通过这种工作方法，赋予了素描艺术极高的声誉，直至20世纪中叶都不曾真正受到过挑战。众所周知，学院派的素描如今在艺术院校中已鲜被教授。对像展武这样的老派的博物馆馆长来说，这样做的结果损失不小。对素描技艺的掌握，能让艺术家熟练自如地运用他们的艺术语言，能让他们用丰富的想象力表达自己。诗人若是没有天才，是学不会如何撰写伟大的诗歌的。但是即使是天才，若是从未学过句法规则，是连任何诗歌都写不出来的。